This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to the Friday Pitch-In, where the show isn't just about one thing. Later, we'll hear from retired Army Major General Dana Pittard. He's a Hoosier and the author of Hunting the Caliphate, the first book on the fight against ISIS written by soldiers and airmen. And coming up, we'll hear from Indiana Public Broadcasting reporter Jeannie Lindsay about the shortage of referees in Indiana. But first, we'll kick off the pitch in the way we always do, a roundup of the biggest Indiana stories of the week with our digital producer, the wonderful Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, how's it going?
I'm okay. But speaking of Jeannie Lindsay, we did a show on Red for Ed on Tuesday, and she was our reporter on the scene. Mm-hmm. Are we talking about Red for Ed today?
We are. We're going to talk a little bit about Red for Ed today. So Jeannie and a few others from across the state were at the State House covering Red for Ed. So I got to be right smack dab in the middle of the action. And let me tell you, there is no experience at the State House like being surrounded by somewhere in the neighborhood of as many as 15,000 teachers, being extremely polite the entire time.
Because they're teachers.
Because they know how to clean up after themselves.
So was that an issue at all? Was there any litter on the grounds?
No.
There was not a thing?
Not a single thing.
Okay.
They even threw away, as the rally was going on outside there, it was packed tight, and it was insane. I'm a fairly wide person, and so navigating crowds is usually a little bit trickier for me. The teachers parted the Red Sea for me so that I could get to places to take photos, so that I could, go through everything. And there were signs that had been dropped that were getting trampled on a little bit. Those were picked up. Everything was put away. There was no debris anywhere by the time that I left the State House on Tuesday. It was crazy.
Well, good on them. I'm not surprised, but I am glad to hear that. So we talked about this on Tuesday when we did the show on it, but let's reiterate. What were their demands?
Yeah, the Indiana State Teacher Association says that its focus was three-pronged. One, they wanted iLearn Hold Harmless legislation passed and passed quickly. Two, that they wanted to repeal career awareness licensure requirement, which is that 15 credit hours of work experience.
Yeah,
the teachers.
Yeah. We did a show on that.
Yeah. And then using surplus money for public schools. So Indiana has somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 billion surplus floating around out there. Mm. And they want it to be put back into traditional public schools.
But as I've heard, they can't really get to any of that because it's not a budget year. So it's kind of a technicality that they might not get what they want.
Yeah. So there's a couple of interesting things that are going on. Speaker of the House, Brian Bosma, brought this up during an event on Monday. And basically he said that he didn't want to give a one-time payment to teachers, which would be what that surplus would do. So, for example, during this legislative session in 2020, the legislators planning on paying off a handful of debt issues or outstanding debts with cash. So they're going to be able to pay off a handful of things to make sure that they have more money in that budget and to make sure that that surplus continues to grow. But as far as adding new things to the budget, Speaker of the House Brian Bosma and Senate President Rod Bray both say, nope, that's not on the table.
Okay. So any other reactions from legislative leaders on Red for Ed and the rally that was held at the State House?
Yeah. Superintendent of Public Instruction Jennifer McCormick, the last elected superintendent of public instruction, spoke during the rally. She basically said that, students deserve every bit of this advocacy. And it's a shame that it takes this kind of action in order to get what students deserve. She was seen almost the entire day with Democrats, spending a lot of time with them during a rally in the South Atrium and kind of hanging around that crowd more than her Republican counterparts.
Yeah, I mean, she is a Republican.
Yes.
She is the Republican. And as you said, the last elected superintendent of public instruction. And to remind everyone, how is that changing?
Yeah, so up until this point, Indiana has had an elected superintendent of public instruction, someone who was, ran as a Democrat. Instead, beginning after 2020's election, the superintendent of public instruction will be appointed by the governor of Indiana. So whoever is governor has just so much more control over Indiana's education platforms than they have at any other point in the state's history.
And the reasoning behind this was to kind of avoid political entanglements. Is that kind of part of it? I know there were a lot of reasons.
Yeah, this kind of goes back to Glenda Ritz and Mike Pence and how they butted heads. And essentially, it created a stalemate between the governor's office and the Department of Education. And so their idea was, well, we want to make sure that that doesn't happen again. In fairness to the Republicans who championed making this change, they were championing this change even after Jennifer McCormick beat Glenda Ritz in 2016. They knew that, you know, no matter if it's a Republican and Republican or a Republican and Democrat, the governor's hands are a bit tied when you have somebody of a different party in that position. And so if you want to streamline what education policy looks like in Indiana, it makes it a little bit easier to, from their idea, to make that an appointed position.
And if you want to know more about Red for Ed, we did a show on it on Tuesday. We had live coverage from Jeannie Lindsay on the grounds. We also talked to the president of the Indiana State Teachers Association. That podcast is up from this past Tuesday. All right, let's talk about Brian Bosma some more. He made a big announcement this week.
Yes.
On Tuesday.
Yes, he did. To the sounds, actually, of Red for Ed demonstrators chanting outside of the House chambers, he announced that he is retiring after 34 years in the state legislature.
And were you there getting tape and you could hear this?
Yes. So,
that's a strange juxtaposition of things, right?
Definitely. I was in this kind of balcony area specifically for media and for people that are invited by lawmakers. Just kind of like the peanut gallery, if you will, before you get to the actual public area for seating. And yeah, no, it was kind of it was definitely an interesting juxtaposition because you have this lawmaker, you know, who's been doing this for 34 years, who has spent 12 of the last 16 as the Speaker of the Indiana House. And all you can hear for the most part from where I was sitting was the teachers, you know, asking for, you know, better pay for their schools.
And he's been sort of somewhat of an adversary to this whole Red for Ed thing as well. And so that was an interesting thing to put those things next to each other.
Yeah, he definitely championed, you know, school choice, which is one of several things that have gone through the state legislature that has created the situation that we are in right now. Mm-hmm. Property tax caps and school choice are the two big things that kind of create the situation. And so he even listed that and touted that as one of his successes when he was talking, when he was leading up to the announcement that he wasn't going to be running for re-election.
But he also sort of gave his counter to Red for Ed and what he sees as some of the problems that mean that teachers aren't getting paid what they are due.
Yeah. During an event on Monday, he basically said, look, you know, over the last 10 years, the number of teachers in the classroom and the number of students in the classroom in traditional public schools has gone down by 3%. But he says that administrative staffers have gone up by more than 30% in that same time period. So he's pointing to, I haven't been able to track down and fact check the data quite yet, but he's saying, you know what, it's actually an issue of bloated school systems with too much administration and not enough classroom resources. And so some of the money that the state has given and allocated to schools, they've put in checks to make sure that it's going to classrooms. But he's pointing to this as one example of where that might not be going exactly the way that he wants.
Oh, okay. And so who is in the running to replace Brian Bosma as Speaker?
There are a couple of names that are floating out there. The one that's most popular is Representative Todd Houston, Republican from Fishers. He's already said he's interested in it. He spoke to Brandon Smith, our State House reporter, and said that, you know, he's interested in basically running. The second in command, essentially, of the Republican caucus in the House, Representative Matt Lehman, Republican from Bern, says he's not interested. He doesn't want the job. He's good.
Okay.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting to see how this shakes out. It'll also be interesting to see how it shakes out based on how they're doing this. So in order to appoint a new speaker, the entire Indiana House has to vote on that person. But during his announcement on his retirement, Brian Bosma said that they want to select a speaker-elect, someone that will shadow him during the 2020 legislative session, figure out exactly how the job works, see all of the pitfalls and the politics of the job, as well as the standards and procedures, so that they're ready to go once he steps down. So they're doing it a little bit differently than they have before. But yeah, it should be an interesting... It should be interesting to see how everything shakes out.
Is it coincidence that 2021 is a redistricting year and Brian Bosma doesn't really like redistricting, doesn't like that process, didn't really like it last time?
Not at all. In fact, when he spoke to media after after his announcement, he said, "I wasn't going to draw a map again, guys, so this is why I'm out." Like, it's been a great run. It's been 34 years. You spent 12 of it as Speaker of the House. I'm good. Thanks, everybody.
Fair enough. Some of the legislators unveiled their 2020 agendas. What was it? The Senate Democrats unveiled their agendas for next year?
Yes. Senate Democrats have officially unveiled their 2020 legislative agenda, which includes those redistricting commissions. Mm. Democrats basically said that they're getting ready to do these legislative district boundaries. They're waiting for the data from the 2020 census in order to make those kinds of informed decisions. But they're also really, and have been for a while, hyper-focused on making sure that the gerrymandering that has happened in the state is rolled back to a certain extent. So that's one of their main concerns. The other main concern that they have is pushing to decriminalize small amounts of marijuana possession. So while not legalizing the drug.
Right, right.
So if it's less than an ounce of marijuana, they would basically treat it like a speeding ticket as opposed to a misdemeanor. And so they're really trying to avoid throwing people in jail, trying to limit jail overcrowding, and take a more reasonable approach to something that is probably going to end up happening more, since most of our neighbors have legalized marijuana in some capacity.
Yeah, and something similar has been done in Marion County with our prosecutor, who said he's not going to prosecute cases of small possession here.
Yeah.
And so we're talking about statewide decriminalization. The Senate Democrats have put that on their agenda. What have the House Democrats said? Have they said anything?
They have not said anything quite yet.
Have the Republicans sort of hinted at what they want to work on next year?
Yes. So at that event on Monday, they talked a little bit about the things that they're looking at. And Brian Bosma said that he's going to personally push to increase the legal smoking and vaping age in Indiana from 18 to 21. And so he himself actually was opposed to it for years, in part because he didn't think that it was fair that Hoosiers could join the military at 18, but weren't responsible enough to make the decision whether or not to use tobacco products. Mm. But he says that after veterans groups had reached out to him, he was like, he was ready. He was on board.
She's our digital producer for Indiana Public Broadcasting, Lauren Chapman. Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving, Matt.
Up next, we'll unpack some of the reporting Jeannie Lindsay did about the shortage of referees in Indiana and the challenge of being female in the male-dominated world of sports officiating. That's next. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. There's been a shortage of qualified sports officials for years now. Why have the numbers of referees been dropping? Where are these shortages most apparent? And what are the implications for those of us who want to play sports? Here to talk with us now about her reporting on the topic is Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay. Jeannie, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Where is this shortage of officials being felt? Is it specific to youth sports or college level?
Yeah, it's kind of all over. I mean, we have been hearing, and it's not just in Indiana either. Geographically, it's all over. In terms of what sports there are, it's all over. High school is the one that I've been focusing on primarily, and it's really interesting how, I guess, complicated the world of officiating is, and I know that we'll get really into that as we talk more, but it's you know, not a unique issue to Indiana. It's not unique to just youth sports. I mean, it's all the way down to, you know, the little kids who are doing sports, all the way up to the college ranks, and it's a problem that a lot of people are focusing on with a lot of energy and time and resources to really get this fixed, to preserve education-based sports.
And can you give us an idea of the scale of the issue, as in, like, how many refs are we down in recent years?
So for high school athletics in Indiana, in the 2016-17 school year, there were about 6,900, so nearly 7,000 officials. That number has dropped off pretty significantly. This year, there were just under about 5,200. So, no, that's a lot of numbers at once, but that's a difference of about 1,700 fewer people that are officiating high school sports in Indiana.
Wow. And there's one demographic where the shortage is especially apparent. Where do we see that?
Right, yeah. And so this story that I have been reporting on, I really was interested in looking at the number of women who officiate games and sports. And so the shortage of officials is definitely, you know, apparent, but among women, it's very, very apparent. So women make up, I think, just around maybe 12% of officials, fewer than 600 of the, you know, 5,200 that are licensed this year for high school sports are women. Most of women officials work in sports like volleyball, gymnastics, softball is really popular, basketball is really popular. But when you get into other sports that are usually male or, you know, primarily boy sports, you know, like football and wrestling, the numbers are even lower.
Now, what are some of the reasons that we see fewer women in these roles?
There are a lot of issues that all referees and officials face, and so that's really challenging. But when it comes to women specifically, I was speaking to Sandra Walter, who is the assistant commissioner for IHSAA, the Indiana High School Athletic Association, and she says that for, you know, women who have families and who also work full-time, that's a hard pull. That's not saying that, you know, men who officiate don't also want to be with their families, but it's a really hard pull for women. In this state specifically. One of the other challenges, too, is just gear. There are some sports where, you know, it's tougher to find the right equipment for, you know, a woman to wear to stay safe while they officiate and watch a contest or a game. And then I guess one of the things that I came upon as I reported this, too, is that because officiating and you know, the referee world is really dominated by men, it's kind of, you know, harder for women to get into that. You know, there's a spirit of camaraderie that, you know, guy refs, you know, who are getting ready in the locker room, you know, hanging out with their friends who are on these crews. And for women, you know, it can be a little more isolating. There's not as many women referees in the locker room when you are one of, you know, three wrestling officials in the state who's a woman. So there's some different elements there. But yeah, it's pretty interesting.
I want to go back to this topic on gear and the costs and the access. Is it easy for women? I guess it's not, to find the right gear for what they need. Why is that?
So one of the referees, the main, I guess, character for my story, the person I talked to a lot, Holly McCamick, she is one of about a dozen licensed football referees in the state. And she was telling me that when you're looking for a football referee uniform, there are no football uniforms that are made for women. So the clothes that she's wearing are made for men. One of the examples that she brought up, too, was just in softball. That's a pretty popular sport for women to officiate. And the chest plates that, you know, an umpire wears when they're standing behind home plate, you know, calling whether it's a strike or, you know, a ball or whatever, the chest plates aren't made to fit a woman's body. And so there actually have been some folks in the state that have been heating up these chest plates and kind of forming them a little bit to, you know, protect a woman while she's behind the plate making these calls, so she doesn't have to worry about adjusting her safety gear or her equipment and can focus on making the right calls.
And Holly had a lot to say to you. You spoke with her, and she's one of only about a dozen licensed female high school football referees in the entire state. What has her experience been like as a woman in the field?
Right. And her situation is actually fairly unique. And I didn't get into this much in the story, but she actually is on a football crew with her husband and her two sons. So when she goes out to football games and she's an official, she's with her husband and she's with her kids on the field. And there were some news stories about it locally up in her area. But I thought that was really interesting because, you know, as a woman, she's surrounded by, you know, her family still there. So there's an element of safety and protection protection. But, you know, just as an official in general, you know, she's told me that she's been very shocked and surprised just by how upset and angry people can get about her calls, how people have come up to her and her husband and her sons while they've been kind of at halftime, you know, criticizing, giving them tips and guidelines. And she says that, you know, that's, you know, hurtful, you know, that's not ideal. But there are some instances where officials have been followed to cars, have been, you know, harassed verbally, have been threatened. Holly, you know, says that she hasn't had a ton of experiences, you know, with those really scary moments. But, you know, there's definitely been a lot of tension and unease and, you know, nervousness about her safety and, you know, her family's safety. But she said that, you know, being with her husband on the field has really helped, you know, and she actually told me that she doesn't think she would do this job if she wasn't an official on the field with her husband.
People who officiate are doing it because they want to give back to the game, because they're passionate not only about the sport, but about the kids. You know, you're doing this for the kids, and you really feel like you're giving a huge chunk of your life to the sport, to the kids, and to be treated very disrespectfully, it's actually been very shocking.
And so that, I think, has been one of the things that has been really hard for Holly, because the reason why she's gotten into this this field, this job, is because she really wanted to stay connected to sports. She wanted to stay connected to the community. And so, you know, having to grapple with some of that tension and some of that hardship after, you know, choosing to do this for, you know, the fun side of it, you know, some of the tension and stresses take some of that fun out of there. So with the, you know, safety components and the criticisms and things like that, I think that one of the contributors to this shortage is just the lack of, I guess, evenness in how hard it is, and, you know, what you get out of it and why you're doing it.
Yeah, fan behavior. And I think anyone who's been to a sporting event knows that officials tend to take a little heat. But are we talking about behavior that kind of goes beyond that?
Yeah, I mean, there at the football game that I was at while I was reporting this story, it definitely, you know, I could hear the crowd, you know, talking to some of the officials. There were some comments made, some "come on, ref, like, why didn't you make this call?" Some of that type of stuff. And that, you know, didn't cause any big problems, and no one was ejected at the game that I went to. But here we can play this clip of Sandra Walter talking about just the rates of how people have been dismissed because sometimes it goes too far.
Our fan ejections are up 25%. That means we are dismissing, when I say we, the officials, are finding it necessary to remove fans at a rate that is 25% higher this year than last year. And I will tell you, last year, that removal was 43% higher than 17-18.
And so when I was talking to Sandra about those ejections, you know, she says that the increase has definitely been noticeable. But one of the things that she's hoping to kind of get at is just the empathy, the humanizing of officials. So she's really hoping that those numbers go down. But yeah, the fan behavior, it's not the only component, but it definitely is a significant factor. And fan behavior, I mean, according to some of the information we've been hearing and seeing, it hasn't been getting better the past couple of years, but she's very hopeful that it does, you know, as we move forward.
Yeah, it's every fan's favorite villain, oftentimes more so than the opposing team. Now, there's an economic element to officiating as well, and I didn't realize the costs officials can often take on. Can you talk about that?
Right. So I was just talking to Sandra this morning, actually, to get a sense of how much officials, you know, actually can make per game. And so when officials, you know, sign up to do this, there's training. They have to register. They have a licensing fee, a registration fee, and that's $50 to $70. But then there are also the equipment, the gear, the uniforms I was talking about how Holly can't find one that's made for her as a woman. You know, she has to buy a kit with all of the, I guess, flags and whistles and all of the things that, you know, officials use to do their job. And she was telling me that when she added up one of the sports that she officiates, because Holly officiates multiple sports. She does volleyball, cross country, track, but she does football, and she added up the expense, and it's about $570 to get her kit, her basic kit, her uniform, and the shirts that they wear are good for a couple of years, but those also change. So every time the uniform changes and the official outfit that you're supposed to be, you know, having on the field or for whatever contest, you know, you've got to buy it. You've got to buy the new one to make sure that you can actually be out there. And so it definitely adds up. Some of the costs, you know, are once every 3 years, but it's definitely a challenge given how much they don't make when they are officiating games.
It seems like that has got to be part of the shortage, the consequence of some people just being unable to justify the time and effort in these roles now compared to the pay and also the expense.
Yeah, and the economy plays a big role in this too. One of the things that Sandra Walter told me was that when the economy is good, you know, and jobs are, you know, bountiful and people are employed, you know, they don't need these side jobs that cause them stress, that, you know, offers risk, not a ton of pay, and then hundreds of dollars in, you know, gear and things like that. So it's tougher to convince people to get on board when they have other options that might pay better, might be a little bit easier to do, just in terms of how people react to what you do in that position. So, yeah, it's tough.
And you report that there are frustrations with the current systems of officials being assigned to games. Where is that frustration rooted?
Right. So one of the things that I stumbled upon in this that I did not expect, there were a lot of things that I learned, but this one was a surprise to me. A lot of officials are assigned games by a person or group of people who, you know, navigate all of the schedules and, you know, the tournaments and things like that. So they'll pick and choose, you know, which crews go to which games, and who's doing what. And one of the things that I learned as I was talking to some folks about this, especially about some of the solutions, is that the role of the assigner is not necessarily a transparent one. So these people have power to pick who's going to these high-stakes games, and they aren't necessarily going through the process very transparently. One of the terms that popped up was good old boys club. So the idea that someone who is an assigner can choose, you know, their friends, their people that they know, the people that they like the most that have done these games before. So it makes it really challenging to move up. And one of the interesting tidbits that I heard was that an NBA official was telling some folks that it was harder to officiate a state finals game in Indiana than it was to officiate for the NBA, which I just thought was very striking.
Wow.
Yeah, it can be really frustrating for people, especially folks who, you know, aren't necessarily just doing this to give back or volunteer, but who really want to do this in some sort of, you know, professionalism type way. I don't know that anybody does this for a full-time job, but, you know, if you have career aspirations, even for a part-time gig as an official, having that sort of limit can be really, really frustrating for people.
There's a class of sports management students at IUPUI who have been researching different solutions to this issue of referee shortage. And how did they approach it?
So one of the interesting things about the way they've been doing this research is that their professor has talked a lot about empathy and human-centered design and research. And so it's kind of the perfect problem, because empathy is such a strong thread throughout how to improve this for officials. And so they have interviewed, you know, a ton of different officials from various different levels. Sandra Walter from IHSAA talked to this class. I think Holly McCamick even talked to some students from this class. And so they've really been just trying to find as many folks and talk about their experiences and then identify some of the issues in there. And so the class is broken up into groups, and there are different groups that are focusing on different things. And it's really interesting to see kind of how they've been working together and working with these officials to ask the right questions, because these officials really are people. And that's kind of the whole basis of how that these students have been addressing the problem.
Yeah. What have been some of their proposed solutions?
So they focused on a lot of different elements here, including the costs, including the training, the role of the assigner. There's a group that's looking at technology and artificial intelligence, how that might improve. So one of the ideas, the group that's looking at the assigner, for example, they're kind of proposing or developing a sort of solution that's like a LinkedIn sort of thing for officials. So officials can have their sort of officiating referee resume on there. And so when assigners or schools or people are looking to have someone, you know, judge a contest or a game, they can look at, you know, who's qualified based off of what sports they've done and how many times they've done it. So that's an example of one thing. Training is definitely another focus. So it's hard to criticize someone's calls if they make good ones. So Sandra Walter has talked about, you know, improving the training of officials so, you know, their calls are more on point with, you know, how they should be doing it, what's actually happening. And then there's another element, especially for this class, there's a group looking at the physical fitness for officials, because that's another element here. I mean, if you've had officials that are running back and forth on soccer fields and basketball games and football games, you know, that's fitness. That is, you are getting a workout. And so it's harder as officials age to maybe keep up with that. Or, you know, if people aren't fit enough, maybe they think they can't be an official. So really just kind of approaching this, these problems and trying to figure out how to make it a little bit easier, because it is so complicated.
Indiana Public Broadcasting's education reporter, Jeannie Lindsay, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks.
Up next, we'll talk about the only book about the fight against ISIS written by actual military personnel. One of the authors is a Hoosier, and he joins us next. I'm Matt Pelser. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Here in our studios at 16th and Meridian, we're just a few blocks north of the Indiana World War Memorial. In fact, the only city in the country with more memorials to veterans than Indianapolis is actually Washington, D.C. itself. So Indiana is dedicated to veterans and members of the armed forces. So when one of our own comes back and wants to tell their story, we want to hear it. Joining me in the studio is co-author of a new book, Hunting the Caliphate, America's War on ISIS and the Dawn of the Strike Cell, retired Major General with the U.S. Army, Dana Pittard. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, Matt, thank you for having me.
You write that you witnessed some pretty difficult things in your military career. How hard is it to deal with some of those memories?
You know, the toughest ones are the ones, I think, from combat, when you've lost someone you've worked with, you served with. That's always tough. And then I guess it's a different way of looking at life, which is you want to make sure you live your life in an honorable way that brings some honor to that person's memory. So there's difficulty there. And then there's also the idea that that you survived and they didn't, because for those who have been in combat, you know that bullets flying or explosions going off, it can hit anybody. So in some ways you feel you know, some survivor's guilt too.
Well, and indeed you bring up a lot of them in this book. So you had to kind of reckon with them to get them just down on the page. What was that like? I mean, how much time did you have to take away from writing when you were writing about particularly difficult things?
This is a 4-year project to the extent. I wrote it on the weekends, sometimes late at night going through it. And sometimes, yeah, you just have to step back and think about it. But this war against ISIS was a war that needed to be fought. ISIS was a scourge. Brutal, murderous terrorist group that took over a third of Iraq's territory. And they had ambitions to do things in the West and in America, evil things. So they needed to be stopped.
Time heals a little, certainly not all. How much time had passed between coming home for good and starting work on the book? Like, when did the germ hit your brain?
Actually, before I retired and before I even deployed back, believe it or not, an elementary school friend called. I was in Baghdad. He said, you know, you ought to write a book. I said, never thought about that. And then he called back and said, you know, I have a friend of a friend, knows a literary agent, and she's going to give you a call. I said, really, Paul, you got a lot of things going on. Well, sure enough, Jan Miller called. She's a literary agent. I had Googled her right beforehand. Amazing who she's worked with. T.D. Jakes, Arnold Schwarzenegger, just some really big names. And she called and said, I understand you're interested in the book or interested in writing a book. And I said, well, I'm thinking about it. She said, well, it'll be about 10 chapters. How about writing a paragraph for each the 10 chapters and then two whole chapters and give me a synopsis and send it to me. Like, okay. So it really caused me to really look inward and really pull out a story. And that's where the co-author came in. I'd asked different people I'd worked with over there in Iraq to send me anecdotes and, you know, just a couple sentences. Well, he ended up sending me 25 pages and it was so well written. I was like, you want to be my co-author? So that's how that partnership started.
I always wonder about that. I'm sure there are a lot of people in the military who have lots of stories to tell. And indeed, we've been, we've been at war in Afghanistan since the early 2000s. And so lots of people have been in the military, and I'm sure there are lots of stories to tell. But I'm sure that they just choose not to tell them because they themselves maybe don't want to think about it. Do you think it's important to share these stories? Or are there people who simply can't? It's too difficult for them. What's the balance?
Well, I do think people ought to share their stories. It's therapeutic in some ways, but it also helps to inform the American people because the bottom line is we serve the American people and America's interests when you're in the military. So it's important that Americans know what their military is doing. There's a lot of really good things that the United States military is doing out there to not only defend American interests but to maintain the peace. So that's extremely important. And then the idea of this story is how it came about. ISIS attacked Iraq. It's a terrorist organization, but very, very well organized with an army. Took over Iraq's second largest city, Mosul, which had over a million people. And then it alarmed the world. And then within 10 days to 2 weeks, I was sent to Baghdad with 100 advisors to look at options. Number one was to protect American interests there, the embassy, other American property, and then to possibly evacuate U.S. citizens. Now, this was in 2014. It had just been 2 years since Libya, Tripoli, where unfortunately our ambassador Stevens was killed. So there was a lot of concern from the State Department, the Defense Department, and the administration at that time, was President Obama, that we didn't want that to happen. And ISIS was on a roll. They seemed like they were a juggernaut that seemed unstoppable. If you look at maps of Iraq, from Mosul, they were coming down the Tigris River Valley, which goes from north to south towards Baghdad. They were going in from the west, the Euphrates Valley. In fact, when I showed up at the embassy, the defense attaché there was saying, ISIS is coming. They're going to take Baghdad. They're going to take it there. You know, he was one of those almost comic scenes where I wanted to just slap him and say, "Come on, man, keep your sense about you." But there was a lot of concern. In fact, a third of the embassy had already evacuated at that point, where they were sent to other embassies in the Middle East or other areas, safer areas in Iraq. So that was the expectation, was to monitor what was going on initially. But within the first 48 hours, they made a bold call. After talking to the senior Iraqi military, who I had known for years, and that was that Baghdad was not going to fall. I did believe that the Iraqi army could defend Baghdad. That was a bold call then, because five whole divisions of the Iraqi army had been defeated at Mosul, and at least folks in the administration, State Department, Defense Department, didn't think that the Iraqi army was up to the task.
Is it true when it comes to this book that this is the first on the fight against ISIS written by soldiers themselves?
Yes.
I mean, that's kind of
soldiers
hard to
and airmen. I mean,
soldiers and airmen.
Yeah.
With regard to this book, it took a while for the Pentagon and the CIA. They had to look at it, and they had to run a classified screening of the book, right? And they wanted to make sure that nothing would compromise current operations.
Right, and we certainly don't want to compromise current operations either. But it normally takes 60 to 90 days to get through the Pentagon screeners. But It took 15 months. 15 months. So the book is on the edge in many ways, and it's quite revealing. We went back and forth with the Pentagon, like, okay, now why is this classified? Well,
that was going to be my other question. What did they say? What did they clear? And what did they – I mean, obviously, you can't say what they didn't clear, right. But
– Well, we got to talk about the topics that any mention of Delta Force had to be taken out. Obviously, we worked very closely with them. And there was other smaller things. But for the most part, it's intact. So it really is a neat and in some places a very, very thrilling story that is true and what occurred.
You shared a little bit about Middle East history and kind of how this all came about. And you know a little bit more about our involvement there and how all of this happened.
I do, actually. I've now spent 5 years deployed in the Middle East through numerous combat tours. And on this one, I'd been in the Middle East for a year. I was at that time the deputy commanding general of U.S. Army Central, which was the Army component command of CENTCOM, Central Command, which has the Middle East for the United States. And it was at the end of the year tour when ISIS decided to attack Iraq, and then I was extended a year, so that in itself was a two-year tour.
The title of the book, of course, is Hunting the Caliphate, America's War on ISIS and the Dawn of the Strike Cell. Can you tell me a little bit more about the strike cell and why that made it into the title?
Sure. The strike cell is almost an evolutionary concept. When we began to actually fight ISIS, and it took a while to do that, and that wanted to pursue ISIS with airstrikes immediately once we got on the ground. But we weren't allowed to really do that for 6 weeks. It was really based on ISIS making mistakes. ISIS made a strategic error in attacking Kurdistan, which has a lot of friends in D.C. and the United States. And so that's when President Obama finally authorized us to conduct airstrikes, but very restrictive. Wouldn't allow us to have our air controllers, JTACs, on the ground. So we had to get innovative on how to do that. Well, America has an enormous amount of manned and unmanned aerial intelligence systems, drones, Predator drones, and all sorts of things. We, for the first time on such a large scale, took advantage of that. We put the JTACs into really a state-of-the-art control center, command and control center, probably about 30 people in there. In front of us, 8 flat screens where we could look at and monitor so much was going on. The boots on the ground would be the Iraqi army, the Kurdish Peshmerga, which is Kurdish military forces. And through having special operations folks at their command and control centers, being able to quickly translate back for air support, and then we're able to see many of our JTACs, and it was special operation JTACs led by Wes Bryant and an F-18 pilot, but it included Navy SEALs, Army Green Berets, and Air Force Special Ops. They were skeptical at first. They said, no, we're used to being in Afghanistan on the ground. And then they saw what we were able to see, and it's like, we see more than we would have seen on the ground. So ISIS could not hide from us. And so this strike cell we were able to conduct airstrikes and bringing multiple different munitions against ISIS on a large scale. Had never been done like that on such a large scale from a strike cell. So that's where I've said this is an evolutionary concept, is the emergence of the strike cell.
Well, I'm sure that you're well aware of some of the criticism against that kind of warfare. I'm sure that you've heard any number of comments from people. But this isn't exactly an enemy who plays by the rules either.
Not at all. ISIS was extremely brutal. In fact, the Yazidis, which was a kind of a tribe in Iraq, and they really attempted to kill them all. It was genocide attempting to. We were able to stop that. But anyone who didn't believe in their version of Islam either had to convert or was killed. And it was a different strain of Sunni Islam. So they were against the Shias. That's the majority of Iraq. The Iraqi government is primarily Shia. Iranians are Shia. So they were very, very brutal and murderous. and they were just killing all sorts of people. In fact, they murdered over 3,000 Iraqi soldiers who had surrendered outside of Mosul. And we didn't find that out until 2017. We dug up this mass grave, the largest mass grave in Iraq. When we were helping the Iraqi forces out and assisting them with airstrikes, again, almost being initially their will, because they had been humiliated by ISIS and thought they needed two more years to get ready. And that's in the book also. We're talking to the Iraqi senior leaders and saying, no, you have just as much training, in fact, more training than ISIS. What you need now is the will to fight, and we're here for you. That's why I ended up in the strike cell sometimes during particular campaigns. I wanted to ensure that there was no issue. I was also what's called the TEA, the Target Engagement Authority. It has to be a general officer to approve them. So we did things very close. It was often danger close. I sometimes got called on the carpet on how close it was. But we made sure that no civilians were hurt. No innocent civilians, what's often called collateral damage, but that no civilians were hurt. I take a lot of pride in that. We got after ISIS. But as there was success, what we found is within 24 to 72 hours of a successful battle against ISIS, where ISIS was defeated, ISIS started murdering Western hostages and beheading hostages. In fact, that was something that weighed on us, because after a while, obviously we saw that pattern. We knew that when we were successful, that one of the Western hostages, even Americans, would be brutally murdered. In fact, ISIS continued to do that until they ran out of hostages.
Politicians like to take credit for military victories. It's been said that President Obama failed to defeat ISIS and that President Trump succeeded. Do you have thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah. It's much more complicated than that. Yes. I was one of the people on the ground who was pushing the Obama administration that we had to take action, that ISIS was, in fact, there's clear and present danger, an existential threat. President Obama came in 2008 to kind of end wars, to get us out of Afghanistan, get us out of Iraq. He got us out of Iraq in 2011. He had really reduced the forces in Afghanistan. So there was a reluctance to now fight ISIS. It was like, wait a minute, that's an Iraqi problem. But what we tried to convince, and I think successfully, is that, wait a minute, that Iraqi problem is a sovereign nation that has a democratic government that is now being invaded by a terrorist organization, a democratic government that we helped to create. So we needed to take action. The campaign plan that was developed under President Obama, and that's what was being executed when President Trump took office. But I will say that what President Trump did allow is more freedom of action for commanders on the ground. And that's appreciated. So that certainly helped. It was still following the campaign. ISIS would have been defeated anyway, but I think ISIS was defeated a little faster with President Trump allowing commanders a little bit more freedom of action on the ground.
ISIS has, of course, been seriously reduced. What more needs to be done?
Well, ISIS as a caliphate, which was a geographical location, they had their capital in the city of Raqqa in Eastern Syria. ISIS as a state or wannabe state has been defeated. However, ISIS as a terrorist organization still exists, and ISIS is still popping up in ungoverned locations, failed states like Somalia, even Libya. ISIS is in Afghanistan. So ISIS has not been totally defeated yet.
The book is Hunting the Caliphate, America's War on ISIS and the Dawn of the Strike Cell, retired Army Major General and Hoosier veteran Dana Pittard. Thanks for your service and thanks for coming on All In.
Oh, thank you.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. Subscribe to us wherever you find podcasts so you always know what we're up to. Join us Monday when we'll talk to the creators of the farming podcast Fieldwork from American Public Media. We'll talk about how a new generation of farmers are fusing modern technology with conventional farming practices, all in an effort to improve sustainability and make money doing it. Not only will this conversation be good for farmers, it'll be good for anyone interested in how our food is grown and how American farms are changing. In the meantime, find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm at Matt Pelser on Twitter if you like. Thanks for listening. This is All In.